Hello and welcome along to another edition of Twilight Football here in the FNR Football Nation Radio Virtual Studio. Josh Parrish and Nick DiBarno taking you right through to 6 o'clock, where we talk all things Australian and a bit of European football as well. We've got a big show lined up. The chairman of South Melbourne Football Club, Bill Papastoyiadis, will be joining us at 5:35. As you may have seen on our social media posts, we did originally have an interview with Western United CEO Chris Pelivana scheduled for today. Unfortunately, he had to pull out. Unforeseen circumstances, these things happen. So that's going to happen as soon as we can reschedule it, hopefully this Thursday, but definitely by next week. Nick, the big news that all of soccer Twitter is talking about is the ABC Four Corners investigation into foreign ownership. Is this another lamestream media assassination of our beloved code?
Good afternoon, Josh, or good evening. First of all, I only just caught up with the documentary literally about half an hour before the show started. Didn't get a chance to watch it last night, so I watched it just before. Yes, we've heard it all before. We know it all. We know everything they're saying. But people, I think, are forgetting that. I think that people are forgetting that just because a program decides to air a documentary about the A-League and it's like, oh, what about all the timing and all that sort of stuff? Not everything is a character assassination of the league. There were probably a lot of people that tuned in last night to Four Corners and had no idea about it, because we can't assume that everyone knows the inner workings of the City Football Group, that every average Joe that walks along the street knows exactly who the Bakery Group are and Adelaide United's ownership and all that sort of stuff. That was genuinely interesting stuff. If I had no idea, I would have been like, that's pretty cool. I want to know about that kind of stuff. I think that we just need to calm down a little bit. Like, we genuinely just need to chill out. We've got such a, like, this mentality, and sometimes rightfully so, to defend our own patch, just go, all right, someone comes at us, we'll go at them back. But sometimes not everything has a nefarious purpose. I don't know if you think the same, Josh. I saw some of your Twitter engagements last night. What were your thoughts, I guess?
Look, I think that the average punter, and this is part of the A-League's problem, I think the average punter would struggle to name the Melbourne-based A-League teams, let alone name their owners and the nefarious activities they get up to. And the average ABC viewer, I mean, you look at their own like presenters, they're not even fans of sports ball at all. So I don't think, you know, ABC viewers of that sort of generation and demographic would have the first idea about all of these revelations that, of course, were well reported on when Melbourne City and City Football Group first came into the league and bought out Melbourne Heart. But the fact that they've just won their first title, I think, makes it relevant news again. And I don't see that saying this is old news. And yes, Four Corners don't usually truck in stuff that's already been reported. They make their reputation on breaking new ground with their investigations. But saying that this is old news is not a defense of the ownership of these foreign-owned A-League clubs. That's just a deflection, saying that this isn't relevant enough to be shared, not that it's not a problem. And I think it is a problem, and it is a moral dilemma that we should be wrestling with, that Melbourne City is being used to essentially launder the international reputation of the Abu Dhabi Emirate. And that doesn't cast aspersions on any of the people who work, you know, on the ground here for Melbourne City as part of the you know, the football department. And it doesn't cast aspersions on the players. It doesn't, you know, say anything bad about how the A-League club is actually run, because by most accounts from the players that we speak to, Melbourne City is perhaps the most professional outfit of all of the A-League clubs. But, you know, it does put a little asterisk next to their name, that their very purpose here is not altogether above board. And I think there was some good coverage of stuff people didn't necessarily know about the Bakery Group. I think we shouldn't stop talking about the fact that nobody knows who the Adelaide United owners are, which is a very murky situation. I felt the section on Sydney FC and David Trakhtsevenko, it was a bit of a stretch. They were trying to imply some sort of Vladimir Putin connection that I didn't feel really existed. And look, that guy has a pretty clean reputation, as clean as anybody who made their fortune in Russia, you know, at the end of the Soviet Union has. So I felt that was a little, that was kind of gutter journalism, but the rest of the expose was entirely valid. And I think this victim mentality that we have is really unhealthy.
It is. And I think we've got to remember that, as I said before, just because there's an expose on a couple of the clubs in this league and the way they're ran and some of the, you know, the things that aren't necessarily squeaky clean is not an attack of the league in itself. This is not the ABC turning around to Channel 10 and Paramount Plus in the league and giving them the big middle finger for, you know, the deciding, obviously, for the rights. And that the league, that the code in itself in Australia is starting to gain a bit of extra popularity with the change of the guard and the new A-League and this whole new era stuff. This in itself, I think we just need to just pump the brakes a little bit because, you know, in so many other leagues and codes around the world, even this country, you think about, you know, when you look back, I saw some people say, well, what about, you know, looking at the dodgy stuff with the AFL and their gambling money? That stuff gets exposed weekly. There was a whole book that just got dropped, a best-selling book that just got dropped, literally exposing everything that has been wrong with the AFL. There's been so many other things that have been done about different codes and everything else. It gets done. It's just that the second it happens with football, everyone just gets on their high horse. Like at the end of the day, as you said, Josh, we just need to accept that this is part of it. Like when you want extra media coverage and extra scrutiny, it's going to happen. When it comes, don't ask for the opposite. It's a lot of contradictions. That's what I'm starting to see this pattern. I know in the past we've seen a lot of different, you know, assassinations of fans in terms of yarns we've seen in the papers and on TV and everything else. That has happened. But I think this in itself, we just need to calm down a little bit. Just simple as that. Relax, guys. It's okay.
It's hardly first tonight soccer shame, is it? And, you know, Edith and I, we've been the first to stand up for ourselves and our code with regards to unfair treatment or lack of mainstream media coverage. But this level of kind of whataboutery, saying, what about the AFL? What about the fact that all this was reported years ago? Like, that doesn't make it any better or any more palatable, CFG ownership and the Bakery Group and their links to certain environmental disasters and match fixing. I mean, the guy who is chairman of the holding company that the Bakeries own Brisbane Roar through was jailed for his complicity in an Indonesian match fixing scheme. I think that should be public knowledge. And Absolutely. If you talk to most Brisbane Roar fans, they are not happy about the Bakery Group's ownership, despite the uptick in the club's recent performances. They would feel a lot more comfortable about supporting the club wholeheartedly if the Bakery Group were to sell up and leave. But the central problem here is Australian football is so cash-strapped that we can't afford to institute any kind of fit and proper person's test. We can't afford to take the moral high ground here, because if money's coming in, we don't care where the money comes from. And that's the position Australian football is unfortunately in. So Football Australia's response when they said they had a fit and proper test for the owners, I'm pretty sure all that means is that they can pay their bills. There is no kind of ethical oversight of A-League ownership, nor is there even a requirement, as Greg Griffin pointed out in the documentary, for A-League clubs' owners to actually disclose themselves. And who knows, if Adelaide United's owners revealed who they actually were, then maybe we'll get another Four Corners expose on them. And maybe that's why they want to keep it secret. And we just can't answer that at this point. So I think it's worthy of investigating and it's worthy of coverage. And the thin-skinned approach of, you know, so many football fans that I saw all across social media last night is totally understandable given the treatment that our sports received in the past, but I do think it's misguided.
It is. And, you know, you talk about wanting to sort of uncover the different owners in sort of world football. I think the most profound example of, you know, not knowing who the owners are and all that sort of stuff, you just got to think back to last year and the big saga that happened with Wigan and some of these other English clubs that went through that sort of stuff with dodgy owners and everything else and all that stuff coming to the fore. These investigations need to happen. It obviously uncovered a whole different can of worms. But at the end of the day, the EFL and English football fans were turning around saying, you character assassinating English football right now in this period of time during COVID, why would you do that? Like, why are you doing all these investigations into owners? You know, oh, it's going to open up other cans of worms and it's going to ask more questions about the CFG and it might go back to different owners. So what? That actually was probably for the best depths of football that these stuff is happening, because we start to uncover that stuff. As you said, Josh, why would the Adelaide United owners want to reveal the stuff if there is things that's going on? I know that sounds terrible in saying it, but that's probably, there might be something more to that. There might be different things. So
we can't look, possibly say, because they won't tell us who they are.
No.
So I think that's, as well, we that's can't make the very basic requirement that has to exist. We should be able to know who owns Australian football clubs. And that really concerns me. And I don't think there has been quite enough coverage of the fact that they're keeping their ownership secret, apart from this one front man who's really just an agent. Comments coming through by the truckload, Nick, across Twitch and Facebook. We're streaming on YouTube and Twitter as well, of course. JP Blockboy says, would ABC produce something like this if they still had the rights to any Football Australia content? Maybe, maybe not. I'm willing to bet that this expose came about because one of the Four Corners journalists learnt about this CFG ownership structure for the first time and pitched it. I don't think there's any wider insidious conspiracy here. Obviously, the timing with the rights going from the ABC over to Channel 10 is a little bit sus, but this is why we have to develop good relationships with mainstream media so that you can have something to bargain with, if you get what I mean. George says, unless FIFA is prepared to abandon the World Cup in Qatar next year, then what are we talking about? Well, I mean, that's another issue, but I don't think that has any relevance to Four Corners and in an ABC Australian context. I think that's an example of this water battery pointing to something else to just distract from the fact that we are fundamentally uncomfortable with Abu Dhabi ownership of Melbourne City and the Bakery Group ownership of Brisbane Roar. Maybe Australia should be taking a harder line. There's been talk, I think, in Norway of actually boycotting the 2022 World Cup in Qatar. I don't expect Australia to do that, but there's been almost no discussion that we would even consider it. And no, maybe we should. I don't know. These are moral issues that deserve to be explored, is my point.
Yeah, absolutely. It's these conversations, I think, at the end of the day, we need to have. If we want to be taken seriously, I guess, as a code, we need to have these conversations. We need to be self-aware. We need to look at this stuff and start posing these sort of questions. Because at the end of the day, we're just going to sift over and go, yeah, whatever. We don't want to touch it because it's too hard for us to look at yourself in the mirror and say there's something not right. Then how's the game going to grow? You know, like the thing is, sometimes the biggest thing, even in just in life, is actually being able to address your mistakes and look at things and go, that just isn't right. And how do you grow? Well, you address it and you get stronger. The league in itself needs to look at it. It's not saying, not turning around to the City Football Group and saying, get out, you know, telling them to abandon ship or telling the Bakery Group to get out, all that sort of stuff. But you've got to ask this stuff. You've got to ask, where's it coming from, you know, because as it's just going to help this game as a whole, Josh. But, you know, we can talk about this doco really all day and sort of sift through every single, you know, iota of it. But I guess the one thing to sort of to say, just my last bit here, is just I think everyone just needs to take a breath. Don't be so reactionary on the Bird app and just relax. Just simply relax. If it's late at night, sit down, get yourself a cup of tea, go to bed. Sleep on it. Sometimes things are more fresh in the morning. We know that very well.
And I should probably take that advice on board as well, if I'm honest. But, Eo Young says, the world's two biggest clubs are playing tomorrow and they are not under fit and proper owners. And a very good point, you know. And it's something we discuss on here quite a lot. Do I expect any substantive change from this Four Corners documentary? Absolutely not. And I saw some criticism saying it didn't propose any solutions. I don't think that's you know, the ABC's job to tell us how to fix the A-League and have, you know, a morally upright position with regards to how our clubs are run and where the money comes from. I think it's a journalistic obligation to spread the word. And that's exactly what they did. So I really didn't have much problem with it. I did think the Sydney FC thing was a bit of a stretch and they were trying to imply things without any evidence. But apart from that, I really had no problem with it. So I think we should take a short break on that note. And we've got heaps of Australian football news to get through. New NPL signings coming through at the Brisbane Roar. Warren Moon has done it again, a man after my own heart. Stephen Taylor's retirement. Johnny Stensness picking the Socceroos over the All Whites. Cammy Devlin's earth-shattering debut for Heart of Midlothian over in Scotland. and a big signing here in the A-League for Western United. All that coming up before we speak to Bill Papastergiadis, who is the chairman of South Melbourne Football Club. He's going to update us on the Lakeside Stadium situation, and hopefully we'll get some information on what's going on with that little tug of war. So that's all coming up after the break here on Twilight Football on FNR. Welcome back to Twilight Football here on FNR Football Nation Radio. I hope you're enjoying the show. Keep your comments coming through underneath. We do read them all. JP Blockboy says, has Western United investigated using Melbourne Ballpark as an alternative venue? 5K capacity in Altona. I did see that discussed. I don't think it's actually quite big enough to accommodate a full A-League field and all the things that have to go around that. One of the big problems with Western United's search for a temporary home is the COVID regulations and how that's going to impact attendances and how many people you're actually allowed to admit to a very boutique NPL-sized venue. I mean, Lakeside is kind of an exception in that regard because of the amount of seats and how spaced out it can be. But yeah, that's a big problem that Western United have run into. They say, and we're hoping to speak to Chris Pelavanis today. We will do very soon in the future. But they say they've pretty much considered every possible avenue. And there are various broadcasting requirements that people don't think about that come into it. There's a direct link up to, I think, the Telstra connection that you have to get because they're going to be producing games out of the remote hub in Sydney this season with the new broadcast deal. There are all the COVID regulations. There are certain corporate facilities that you have to have. You know, the A-League is a bit of a different kettle of fish, and sometimes, you know, atmosphere and geography take a back seat to these kinds of other considerations, unfortunately. So they're working on the new stadium. There were some new service roads and work on basically building the infrastructure around the construction site so that they can actually get the trucks in to get the materials there. That's going ahead later this or next month, is it? So that was the announcement they had the other day. So the stadium is still a work in progress, but I think it's incumbent on the club ownership to really get a move on in that regard. And the people actually working on the day-to-day are doing their absolute best to try and find a suitable venue. And now this South Melbourne thing has come up, which we're going to talk about with Bill Papastergiadis in about 15 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. I think one thing we've got to remember is, you know, there's, as you did say, we want to have a ground where not just it's viable for broadcasting, but actually if you get there, you don't feel like you're so far away from it because, you know, like they mentioned literally everything, you know, Chirnside Park in Werribee as well, a VFL venue really. And it's, you know, your typical state league sort of footy sort of oval. It's not necessarily one you want to be going to an A-League game for. We're complaining about ovals, you know, playing at Marvel Stadium and playing at these non-rectangular stadiums. And, you know, we get an opportunity to play at Lakeside, people are still sort of throwing their toys outside of the pram. Not about South Melbourne, but other people saying, why would you go play there? It's in the east. Well, look, at the end of the day, they've tried every option in the west. And about the Melbourne ballpark array, it's not just the COVID thing, Josh. It's putting a football pitch on a baseball pitch. Is that really... I was literally sifting through. I don't think they've ever actually played. Someone might be able to correct me. Played a football game at Melbourne Ballpark Arena. I see that... we've got JB Blockboys asked again, Princess Park in Carlton. They have to go through Carlton on that one as well. Carlton used that as a training ground. The AFLW starts at literally a month after the A-League starts as well. That's a whole nother problem in itself. And they'd probably be having clashing time slots and everything else. You've got to then, you know, think about the lines, get the lines off the ground, then you have to get the pitch on. It's that in itself is a very much a logistical nightmare in the same way that it is at almost playing it. GMHBA Stadium and their issues with Geelong. So there are a lot of problems they've got to work through, Western United. And look, you know what? Really right now, their only options are starting to fall back to, do they end up back at Amy Park if this Lakeside Stadium thing doesn't work out? Or, you know, if they've just got to play at Lakeside for the time being and people just got to suck up, you know, just got to take it. Yes, not in the West, but there's nowhere else they can go. The furthest Marvel. West stadium they might be at, Marvel, but...
Marvel's again, huge, but Marvel might end up being the only option if Lakeside doesn't come through for them.
55,000 seat stadium.
I mean, you'd close the top two tiers, surely.
Yeah, if you were gonna do that. You know, they would just look terrible on TV.
It would look bad, but, you know. I mean,
look, if they really, play somewhere, really right? have to, yeah, but then you have to think about leasing agreements with the AFL and all those sort of stuff. It's going to create just more and more cans of worms. And Josh, we've only got 6 weeks for the season. Like, they've got to sort this stuff out now. And, you know, they're leaving it late, and that's the unfortunate fact about it. Even the Mariners are going through their own problems. I saw all their home games are still TBD. They haven't even locked in playing at Blue Tongue yet. So, you know, there's all sorts of logistical problems going on at the moment, Josh. But one team that doesn't is Brisbane. I mean, they sorted out their stadium stuff last year, and it's been for the best. And now they've got some two exciting new signings, to say the least.
Absolutely. We were calling, I mean, during the Robbie Fowler era, if enough for more local Queensland talent to get a go, for them to, even before Robbie Fowler was appointed, for them to look to the NPL, and specifically Warren Moon. I remember we talking about him as Lions FC coach, as a potential option for their new head coach. And it took a little bit longer than we would have liked, but he is well and truly in charge now. He's got his feet under the desk after one season, and he's continuing to put faith in local Queensland NPL talent to fill out their A-League squad, which, you know, a lot of clubs aren't brave enough to do. They go for the older players or the tried and tested, as opposed to A-League rookies and guys who've maybe been involved in youth setup but not played senior football, like Jez Lofthouse and Henry Hoare. And I'm particularly excited by Jez Lofthouse because he's the kind of player I can see becoming a bit of a cult hero in A-League circles. If you haven't seen him play, he's a really stylish, elegant player to watch. Loves taking players on, loves cutting inside from the left and curling one into the top corner with his right foot. He's got the low socks, the long hair. He's a surfer. He actually had opportunities to move to the Victorian NPL that I'm aware of, but even though that's a more high-profile competition, he decided to put the brakes on that and even, you know, possible trials with A-League teams down here because he wanted to live in Queensland and he wanted to be close to where the surf is good. So I completely sympathize with that. Apparently he's very good. He's actually like surfed competitively as well.
Wow.
I don't know if it's like a new Elise Perry situation here, but I love that. And I think he's going to be embraced by A-League fans. However he does on the pitch, he just seems like a cool character.
Well, I mean, I wonder if they're going to have to introduce some sort of, with Warren Moon, soon as entering from a semi-professional to now a full professional A-League environment, just in terms of cutting down the surfing just a little bit in case of injury. We've seen some injuries in the past, did some innocuous accidents with outside activities. So I think you'll be fine. I think surfing is quite, well, someone who only boogie boards very, very rarely, I think it's quite a low-risk activity. In terms of injuries.
Unless you're Ryan Grant, who nearly drowned that one time.
Yeah, but look, I think that if Jez is quite experienced, hopefully we won't have a situation like that. But the other one, Josh, told, we've actually seen quite a bit down here this season. Henry Hoare from South Melbourne getting heading back home. What are your thoughts on Henry Hoare, seeing him a lot more this season? He came in with a lot of excitement. I remember we did his first game down at Jack Edwards against Heidelberg, and, you know, he's had quite... pretty good season, to say the least.
Yeah, I'm surprised, to be honest, that he's the player they've picked out and said you. Obviously, he went back up to Queensland to play in local NPL, and I haven't watched as much of him there as I did in Victoria, not nearly as much. So perhaps he's had an outstanding campaign whenever he's played in Queensland. And that will have been the footage that Warren Moon's been most interested in, because he's looking at local talent from in their state, and it's also just logistically easier to get somebody who's already up in Brisbane than trying to get someone to travel interstate at the moment. It's a big headache. But Henry Hoare as a player, I saw him at South Melbourne quite a bit. He works really, really hard. He's a good dribbler, very quick, especially over the first 10 yards, and he'll press relentlessly. I wasn't too impressed with his finishing and with his final ball and kind of decision making. He always looked a bit rushed. But then again, he was operating in a South team that I don't feel had a very clear attacking game plan, and they had a very inconsistent selection of players. They kept changing the 11 every single week. So I think it was hard for him to get settled and comfortable in Victoria before the season was suspended. So in a more cohesive setup at the Roar, we might see the best of Henry Hoare. I'm certainly more optimistic and more excited about Lofthouse and watching him. But, you know, I trust Warren Moon's judgment, to be honest. He's taken players who, haven't exactly shone, and even in sort of NPL setups in Melbourne, say a Josh Brindle South, and made him into an A-League regular. Mm. So he seems to have a good eye for players, and I would defer to his judgment.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think it's a scholarship deal, if I'm saying correctly.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a low-risk kind of signing. I think it's more of a long-term kind of deal, sort of to see for the future. And I don't see him. I'd probably see Loftus having a bigger role, I guess, in the immediate future than Hall. Maybe Hall will get sort of eased in, and, you know, if fixtures start coming thick and fast, they're through to the next round of the FFA Cup, they might throw him in there for the round of 16, whatever their next game may be. So I think it's one that's definitely sort of with that project in mind. And they have built a bit of a young nucleus with some of these guys. You know, think about Parsons and some of those other guys they've brought in. And they like to get those sort of young sort of forwards in. And they've lost Riku Danzaki this year, which is a massive loss. So there is a position that is open for one of those guys to really grasp. But I think it'd be good to see if one of them can do it. Be another great story of someone emerging from the NPL.
Absolutely. Well, we'll move on to some of our other news before we chat to Bill Papastoriadis. Stephen Taylor, all of a sudden, has announced his retirement from football after supposedly being, you know, captain and part of the Wellington Phoenix plans for the upcoming season. It's really shocking news, to be honest, because I felt he was still one of the outstanding defenders in the A-League when he made his return from India in the second half of last season's campaign. And honestly, I'm really sorry to see him go because I found him very entertaining player to watch, very good value in an interview. And I think his leadership has been invaluable to Wellington Phoenix over this, you know, checkered couple of years with coaching changes and the hub out of Wollongong. It's been a difficult time for them. But I've always really enjoyed his contribution to the A-League.
Yeah, it's a big loss for the A-League in terms of personality as well. We've known him as the king of S-housery throughout his whole career for his antics at free kicks. He loves to put off the goalkeeper. If those at home haven't seen it, go on YouTube and search up Stephen Taylor and Asmir Begovic, or even more locally down here as well. I think it was against the Western Sydney Wanderers. He did it a couple of times. You know, look, it is a glowing character gone as well from the change rooms for Wellington. It's another leader, and they were a lot better when Taylor came back last season, that second half of the year. And it's a real shame. Philip Rollo wrote today on stuff.com that if they maybe stayed at home, he might have been open to sticking around for a bit longer. And I think the hub sort of logistics made it a bit hard for him. So it's a big loss. It says well for the, you know, the mix zone as well. And also for those who'd like to get on a jet ski with him. You know, we've seen that there was that competition where you win and you get a free ride with Stephen Taylor on a jet ski. But unfortunately, no more jet skis humming around either the Wellington Harbour or down in the Gong as well, unfortunately. So, yeah, it's a big loss for the league and as well for the Knicks, really. But every time the Knicks have been doubted in these situations, I think I'm going to park it because they always find a way to make us, you know, just go, what the hell? Like, where did this come from?
Well, I want to draw your attention to the comment section now, Nick, because we've had comments on two different platforms here, and it seems the fans are clamoring for a centre-back called Brian Kaltak, who plays in the New Zealand Premiership. Fijian footballers overseas says, Brian Kaltak from Vanuatu from Auckland City deserves a chance now that Phoenix will be short a centre-back. And then over on Twitch, JB Blockboy says, few good centre-backs floating around in the New Zealand Premiership. Brian Kaltak springs to mind. The fans are clamoring for him, Nick. Give him a contract already.
Brian Kaltak, yep, absolutely.
I've never seen him play.
The issue is he's could be the first, I don't know, is it, well, Vanuatu born player to potentially play.
There's a player who plays for Hume City at the moment who represents Vanuatu internationally.
But in the A-League, we haven't had.
He played in the A-League for, I can't believe, Mitch Cooper.
Mitch Cooper.
He played with Newcastle Jets and Melbourne City. I don't know if he was born in Vanuatu, but he certainly has Vanuatu heritage. But yeah, speaking of this Fijian footballers overseas account, I do note in the world of Fijian football that Dan Hall from Central Coast Mariners has put his hand up for Fijian national team selection, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
So good on Dan Hall.
Yeah, and also I think now going back, so the go off topic, but I think the other one was Benjamin Totori from the Solomon Islands. He played down here at Wellington, I think, for a season. So the Oceania flavour, the diaspora continues to grow. Good to see we get some more guys given a chance. And who knows? I mean, short-term deal, see how he goes. And they'll probably put a few players through the ringer. Maybe Winston Reid could be another one who's just recently been released from West Ham. I think that the Knicks actually ruled out making a move prior to Stephen Taylor actually announcing his retirement, but maybe they're rethinking things now.
Two items to get through before we go to a break. Gianni Stensness has refused a New Zealand international call-up in the hope of being called up for the Socceroos in the future. So at 22, playing the long game, what do you think of this decision?
It's a bold one. I mean, it's a very bold one, considering that in, 5 years' time, there'll be an expanded World Cup. So, I mean, the chance of New Zealand playing in the World Cup definitely increased, because you'd have to think Oceania may get one automatic spot, and they're always the
team.
Or
they'll be playing a playoff against a lower-seeded opponent at the very least.
Yeah, absolutely. So you'd think that at least...
That is unless the Fijians get their way, Nick. So
potentially. I'd love to see Fiji at the World Cup. You know, I think it would be... I think it's a big, big call. But you know what? Like, he had a really good season last year, Josh. He was very good at the Mariners. He got an overseas move. I think that the thing that works against him, though, is just how deep that centre mid depth is at the Socceroos right now. But I appreciate the boldness. He may decide to... This isn't him, you know, sort of locking himself into the Socceroos. This could change if in a couple of years' time it doesn't look like he's getting anywhere and doesn't look like he's getting any closer. He could always go back. But you know what? If he continues to grow overseas, it could be an option maybe for a qualifier down the track, maybe after the World Cup. I think right now it's a bit of a big bit of a stretch, but before the World Cup, considering the importance of these games.
Yeah, and look, the central midfield depth for the Socceroos is huge. The thing that interested me about it is he's actually been fielded as a centre-back by the New Zealand Olympic team. And I haven't seen him play there, but I can see it working given just his physical characteristics. He's very tall. He's very mobile. As a ball-playing centre-back, I'm always a fan of midfielders being converted to defenders, having gone through the same transition in my own playing career, which is nothing to write home about. But it's a fun spot to play if you've got the range of passing that Stensness has. If he likes playing there and he's willing to pursue it, I see an easier path for him into soccer selection, especially when if you've got that versatility, having a player who can play in two key positions in your squad is very valuable.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And last one before we welcome Bill Papastoyiadis to the program, Cammy Devlin making waves in his Heart of Midlothian debut over in Scotland. He was given one of the Man of Match awards. He absolutely killed it in the center of midfield. He had the home fans chanting his name already. They love his work ethic and his kind of never say die, scrappy do approach in the center of the park. I'm just so happy for him. What a move! And I hope this golden run of form continues for him.
Yeah, another Aussie making the big move to Hearts. I hope he's learnt the Heart song off by heart, because I'm sure, as we know, Josh, many of us have in the group chat due to Lockie's video that has circulated many times and it's become the songworm. Yes. Hopefully he does know what HEARTS does stand for. But, you know, it's a good start to life in Edinburgh for him. And I'm really excited. Hopefully it can help, you know, sort of springboard his sort of own individual prospects. He's gotten better every season, and it's good to see that he's adjusted to the Scottish Premier League brilliantly.
Yeah, dream debut. Nick, with that, we will go to a very short break here on Twilight Football. On the other side, we will be talking to South Melbourne Chairman Bill Papastoyiadis about the ongoing Lakeside Stadium tug-of-war. You do not want to miss this. And we're back here on Twilight Football, here on FNR Football Nation Radio. Josh Parrish and Nick DiBarno with you. And joining us now is the chairman of South Melbourne Football Club, Bill Papastoyiadis. Bill, thank you so much for making the time.
Thanks, Josh. Thanks, Nick. And it's good to be on your program, and refreshing to see that football still has a voice, despite the fact that we're not seeing any games being played at the moment here in Victoria. But let's keep the energy going as much as we can.
I appreciate that, Bill. Let's get straight into it. South Melbourne, not owners of Lakeside Stadium, but have this long-term lease. What makes this arrangement unique and different to your run-of-the-mill tenants?
Absolutely. We need to remember that back in the mid-90s when the Grand Prix was set up in Victoria, and particularly in Melbourne, we had to sacrifice our stadium as part of that deal. And so the Kennett government approached us, being good citizens in Victoria. We agreed to a relocation and the destruction of our home, because South Melbourne has been a part of, our football club has been a part of South Melbourne for well over 61 years now in that area. So our DNA is there, our players have been through there, our supporters have, you know, walked up and down that part of Melbourne for decades. So we engaged with the government, we worked with them, and we moved to new premises. As part of moving to those new premises, we also invested heavily in the development of Lakeside Stadium. So in equivalent terms, we put in well over $10 million into the development and the construction of the stadium we currently see. So we're not just simply a body that's come across and put its hand up and asked for a tenancy. We're a football club with DNA in the area, representing the South and the Southeast, and who, as part of its history and the fabric, the social fabric of our beautiful city, invested money, entered into an agreement, the agreement of which gives us certain rights because of what we gave up. That's what the government promised us. And those rights relate to us having certain vetoes in relation to direct competitors. Being good citizens of football in this state, we haven't used that veto willy-nilly. In fact, we've hardly ever used it. So the Victory and the City football clubs have had youth teams come through. We've had their women's football teams play with us. So we've made sure we've accommodated football as much as we can to ensure that this is a facility that's of use to all of us. But at the same time, protecting the tribe that is South Melbourne, the passion that is South Melbourne, the museum that sits within that facility, our social club, the communication rooms, our offices, our boardroom, our corporate suites. Got to remember, all of that is part of Lakeside, which has a relationship, direct relationship to South Melbourne FC.
So let's talk a little bit more about this veto power. Has the club ever actually exercised it in the past? And what does it actually consist of?
No, we haven't. As I've indicated to you before, we've made sure that we've worked with other codes, for example, league that's expressed an interest in playing there, international football through Football Australia, Football Federation Australia approaching us again. We've made sure that we've accommodated all codes, including our own code, in the course of the use of that stadium. And so what we did when we bid for the A-League license, and Josh and Nick, you'll probably remember a few years ago that we were down to the last four from, I think, 16 original bids. So our bid was outward in saying, and these are the words we actually used, we do not, as South Melbourne, intend to cannibalise the existing A-League clubs. What we aim to do is to bring a new stadium into the A-League, that is Lakeside, the stadium that we have a lease and license over, and that Lakeside is essential to our bid. And again, our bid made the point very clearly. No other club, and again, these are the words we used in our bid document, no other club has an equivalent stadium deal to which Lakeside does. Now, we saw with Western United, and congratulations to them for succeeding in their bid, put across the construction of a stadium in the West, capturing the West as its area of interest and also supporter base, with the construction of a stadium that ought to have been constructed by now. And, you know, that we were competing in football. Let's not forget, it's about competition. It's about tribes. It's about making sure that you deal with the passion that's around you. And I think we were pretty clear about where we stood, where we didn't want to cannibalise other consortiums or bids or existing A-League clubs. And we wanted to differentiate ourselves as being within the South, the Southeast. And as part of that bid, we got over 30 other clubs to issue letters of support that they would work with us in this catchment area. So it's a part of our DNA and a part of our fabric.
Bill, are you at all a bit disappointed with the lack of communication from, I guess, for both sides here? Because it seems like that there was a bit of a hoodwink situation where things were sort of done at the last minute and you're given maybe a few hours' notice that it was going to go through in the fixturing.
Great question, Nick, and I think that's spot on. And I think that goes to the crux of where our concern lies and what's happened as a result of that lack of communication, as a result of seeking consent, as a result of not working with us as a partner, given what I've explained to you, given our financial investment, our emotional investment, and our history. We feel pretty upset about all of this, but it's not us. We're talking about our supporters because, you know, we've got six decades of playing out of South Melbourne. We've supplied almost more footballers at national and international level than almost any other club, given the fact that we've been out of mainstream football, that is the A-League, for 14 years. You've got to remember, only a few years ago, we had Ange Postecoglou as the national team coach. We had Michael Valkanis as the City coach. We had Kevin Muscat as a Victory coach. These are South Melbourne players. We've been out of football for 15 years, but our DNA is still heavily present in the fabric of this beautiful city. And you know what? It's not hard to extinguish because that's what football's about. It's about pride and passion.
So I guess what's the sort of the strategy from here? I mean, Western United said yesterday they're looking to come to some sort of resolution by the end of the week. Are you planning to sit down with Western United, sort of discuss how things are going to go from here? What's South's stance on this?
Look, our position is that this stadium was aligned with our bid, that this stadium is part of our DNA, and that this stadium is part of our future for the next 35 years that we're the major football tenant pursuant to our lease and license agreement. You've got to remember that during the A-League bid, Greg O'Rourke and Falvo and quite a number of the other FFA executives visited our stadium as part of this bid. You know, the other thing they didn't do was measure the length of the grass, the blades of grass. They looked at our communications room, the change rooms, the social club and museum that sits there. I don't think these aspects of our club can be easily transportable to another football entity that we would consider to be a direct competitor. I don't believe they can be.
So
as much as we want to help, I don't believe they can be.
So there's no like doubting the emotional and traditional connection to Lakeside that the South has. But I've seen it written that South have to, in order to exercise this veto power, have to make a business case for how, you know, Western United playing there would harm the club's business. Is that accurate?
I don't want to go into the specifics because okay. That agreement is confidential. But what I can say to you is that the rights bestowed upon our club are significant. Those rights are not rights that we've exercised frivolously in the past. We haven't. But sure. What we aim to do is to protect our club, our supporters, and our future. We are fighting for our future here. This is a club that wants to play top-tier football. This is a club that has so much history. You've got to remember, as part of that A-League bid, we topped 8 consecutive polls in the Herald Sun with tens of thousands or well over 10,000 people voting. And we got over 57% of the voter support for the club that should be the next entrant. And I remember, as part of our bid, quoting Mike Peterson, Trimboli, Postecoglou, Alan Davidson. And the words they used in our bid was that South Melbourne was the club that every youngster dreamed of playing for, and I lived that dream. That was Peterson. Trimboli, I spent 17 years of the best years of my life there, and it's so significant for Australian history. And Postecoglou's words were, it shaped me as a player, it shaped me as a coach. We can't give that up, guys. As much as I'd like to give that up, our supporters wouldn't accept us giving that up.
So you've talked about fighting for your future here. I mean, Western United aren't here to defend themselves, but I think they would say they're not aiming to use this stadium into the medium-term future even. It's just a temporary arrangement to get them through this season and get them a year closer to building their stadium. They don't want to use Lakeside in the long term. And I don't think any of their fans would want to use Lakeside in the long term either, because it doesn't represent where they're geographically supposed to be based.
Well, where are the guarantees for that? Because when the bid process was finalised for the A-League, it was announced that a ground would be built within 2 to 3 years. They haven't turned any soil yet. I'm not criticising them. I wish them well. I wish their support as well. I want them to do well. I want them to build their stadium, but I want them to be true to their word. We've been true to our word, Josh and Nick, and we haven't relied upon any other club for our bid. We haven't gone out seeking to cannibalise other existing A-League clubs as part of that process. We worked with what we had, the hard, you know, the sweat, the blood, the tears that's been shed. You can't manufacture that passion that South has. It's not, you can't manufacture that. It's real. It's present. And I can tell you, leaving aside what I think or what Nick Mikusis thinks, who's doing a great job as president, or Andrew Mezzaruni is the football head of the football there, leaving aside whatever we think, our supporters have spoken. I mean, social media has lit up like as if we're playing UEFA Champions League. That's been the passion. So it does reveal that my view almost to some degree is irrelevant at this point in time. We would have, you know, the equivalent of the vaccine protests in the city outside that stadium if Western United turned up, and that's been some of the messaging. So we want to protect the integrity of football.
And, you know, Dimitrios has come through in the comments saying every SMFC member supports the club stance. I think it would be close to unanimous there. JB Blockboy in the comments with a really good question, and I think this is maybe the most important point of the whole discussion. Does this not bring to light a bigger issue of the lack of football facilities in Victoria? Not one NPL ground good enough to use? Should more be done by Football Victoria and Australia to build better infrastructure that can be used by multiple parties?
Exactly the point that we've been making now for 5 years since this whole process commenced. This whole conversation should be about football infrastructure. And it goes to the point about when we were notified that we weren't the successful bidder, it was down to four of us. The point that was made to me personally over the phone by the FFA was, well, we couldn't knock back football infrastructure to the value of 150 million. So I think that's where the emphasis should be, that we need more stadiums, we need more infrastructure, and we really wish Western United strength and speed in progressing with their facility and hopefully one day playing against South Melbourne when we're in the A-League in the near future. But that's a conversation that Western United and all of us need to have with Football Victoria, Football Australia, and with the state and federal governments. I know that I have strong support from government for Lakeside at both state and federal level. And I know as part of our bid, we had assurances about upgrading our stadium, but we didn't get up. But I had those assurances. Now, when the time comes for us to bid again, well, I don't think hopefully it'll be a bid this time. Hopefully it'll be the red carpet laid out for us to enter in terms of what we can bring. That we'll be able to contribute additional infrastructure to the football landscape.
Bill, just a couple more before we wrap up. We've got another question just come through in the comments. If Western United were more engaging and transparent in their plans, would South Melbourne have a different view to the proposed stadium deal?
A very good question. I can't answer that decisively because leaving aside our own personal view about providing assistance to clubs, and as I've indicated before, exercising a veto has not been something that we've done lightly and haven't actually exercised it. But we also have to be respectful towards our members and our supporters. And I think they've spoken loudly on this issue.
Last one, Bill, from just, me. Go on, Nick. Sorry.
Oh yeah, Bill, I was just going to ask, might just be, Josh, sorry if you're just going to dovetail away quickly from the topic, but any word, I guess, with the FFA Cup starting and obviously with the roadmap, any word of when the game against Melbourne City might be happening? Talk about rolling out the red carpet. That's the the big ticket event that might get Australian football back in Melbourne.
Now, that should be the conversation point, Nick. Spot on. We're looking at late October, early November. We've got good dialogue with Minister Pakula, the sports minister, Minister Foley, the health minister, and the premier. They all want to make it happen. And we're hopeful to schedule it at a time where we can get supporters in there so we can see the buzz and the energy which football brings to this beautiful city. So, you know, fingers crossed, sometime early November, with the stadium that's either half full or three quarters full and chanting loudly for two of the premier clubs in Australia.
And last one from me, Bill, National Second Division. I think everyone wants to see it happen. We've seen a lot of delays. COVID has played a part. It's a bit like the Western United Stadium in a way. It's National Second Division by whatever year it is, plus two. But how's the preparation going for it? Where are the discussions at currently? And how likely do you think this thing is of actually getting up in the next couple of years?
I think we have the commitment of Football Australia towards getting this done. I think Chris Nicu and the CEO, James Johnson, are showing great leadership. Nick Galatas from the AAFC is also doing an excellent job there. There's quite a number of clubs like Melbourne Knights and Heidelberg and, you know, the Oakleys and all sorts of clubs within Melbourne that have expressed interest. I believe it's going to happen. I'd like to see it happen in 2022, towards the end of next year. We've been talking about this for such a long time that it's now time for action. The talk is cheap. The talk is over. This is essential for football to survive in this country. The A-League has its problems. We all know that. I don't think any of the A-League clubs are hiding from that issue. What's the best way to develop that buzz going into football? To have clubs competing for promotion and other clubs fighting not to be relegated. I'm not saying that's going to happen at the start of the second division, but it'll be part of the conversation in the near future. And I think that's the gelignite that's going to ignite football again in this country. South will be right there in the mix. And I think we've got good support nationally, but also within the state to make it happen.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for making the time to chat to us. It's been great to hear your thoughts, and we look forward to catching up with you very soon in the future.
Josh, Nick, thank you for your time. Always here, always to engage in a conversation. We might not agree, but we certainly want to make sure that all of us get the opportunity to express ourselves. Have a great evening, guys, and thank you to all of your listeners.
Thanks, Bill. We're going to take a short break here on Twilight Football. And on the other side, me and Nick are going to wrap up our personal highlights from the weekend of European football and look ahead to the UEFA Champions League. So stick around for that. And we're back here, Twilight Football on FNR for the final time this evening. And it's time for us to turn our attention to Europe. Nick, we've got Champions League coming up tomorrow morning. But of course, it was a big weekend of league football on the weekend. What was your personal highlight from what you saw? I'll accept either.
Oh, look, you know, I think in terms of me just being a football, not just a Milan fan, but a football purist, but how good is it when you see a father-son reaction in the crowd? Like when you see the son score and the dad get all excited. Daniel Maldini scoring his first goal for Milan in his first career start against Spezia on the weekend, and the reaction from Paolo Maldini in the crowd was brilliant. I think for me, that's definitely a highlight. And the other highlight as well is, how about them Gunners, man? How about them Gunners? They're back.
Yeah, are they back, though? Are they back? Yeah. I don't know. Tottenham made it pretty easy for them. I think it's
more about Tottenham.
I think it does, because when you try and press, but there's like wide open spaces between your attack and your midfield and your midfield and your defense, I think Arrigo Sacchi would have been, you know, throwing his hat on the ground and stomping on it watching that. Because they just abandoned the central principle of, you know, European football, the central defensive principle of the last 30 years.
Yeah, and it's funny because, you know, the crux of Nuno Espirito Santo's game is to keep it compact, but he played Dele Alli and Ndombele as eight, and, you know, left Højbjerg completely isolated, and they were just completely picked apart. So, yeah, maybe it does say more about Tottenham, but Arsenal won a derby. That's pretty, it's good for them. It's great. Three wins in a row.
Not long since Nuno Espirito Santo was named Premier League Manager of the Month, and Spurs fans were taking screenshots of the table with Spurs on top and Arsenal on the bottom. Now Arsenal are above Spurs, so shows you football giveth, will taketh away.
How the turntables? That's not Michael Scott.
And we've got someone saying, what about Aston Villa? Missing Leon Bailey and reconciling Buendia on the bench. Looking good. They still beat Manchester United. My highlight actually does come from the Villa game, and it was the S-housery, the antics, the mental games, the mind games of Aston Villa goalkeeper Emi Martinez as Bruno Fernandes stepped up for that last minute stoppage time penalty. He knew just what to say to get into Bruno's head, and that was to rather theatrically point straight at Ronaldo and saying, why are you not taking it? Not him, you. You got to take this. It's a last minute penalty. It's what you do. What the hell? And Ronaldo, I think, was confused for a moment because on the one hand, the opposition goalkeeper is the enemy. But on the other, he probably agreed with what Emi Martinez was trying to say. And Bruno just steaming, the absolute rage in his eyes as he stepped up to blast that 30 meters over the crossbar. I don't think he would have got the velocity on that ball if Emi Martinez hadn't got into his head. And then the celebratory pelvic thrusting dance afterwards was hilarious as well. So I just got to applaud it. You got to applaud it.
Absolutely. And I mean, he did it at the Copa America to Yerry Mina and it worked. So it's a tried and tested formula. You know, I think we've got to really look into this. How many times has Emi Martinez been able to psych people out of the spot? Is he the king of mind games in the Premier League? But
the
you know
heir
what,
to Mourinho's throne, perhaps.
Potentially. And I must say, Fernandes kicked that, the way he struck that penalty was like he was an angry kid on a playground just kicking the ball away after something hasn't gone his way. He didn't hit it like he was going for a penalty. He kicked it away like out of frustration. So, and then he wrote a five deep paragraph essay, which he put up on Twitter and social media, apologising. Even though it's only, match day six or match day seven, just saying, you know, I'm so sorry for the action. It's like, get over it, Bruno. It's going to happen, man. You just got psyched out.
Exactly. And like, I side note, but I hate this habit of footballers feeling like they have to take to social media to apologize, to sort of place themselves on the cross and say, please, please, God, forgive me to all the supporters. I mean, come on, you missed a penalty. It happens. Like, we've got to get this out of the game. This is really unhealthy stuff. No longer can you just go home and stew about a missed penalty. You have to embarrass yourself in front of all your followers just to make a recompense. So, it's ridiculous.
So we have Bruno Fernandes being a martyr on social media, and we have Manchester United playing martyr football with Cristiano Ronaldo in the side. It's some sort of correlation going on here. I don't know. I might have just said the word is what the correlation is, but you guys at home can work it out.
You can connect the dots. Looking ahead to the Champions League, and I've just seen friend of the show, Nick Stoll, announce on Twitter that Football Zone, a UCL version of Red Zone / Goal Rush, will allow you to watch every highlight from all six matches live on Stan Sport, which just continues, I think, the slam dunk, the succession of slam dunks that Stan Sport have made with regards to their coverage. With regards to their pricing, and I think, you know, everyone knows my thoughts on that. But it's the best football coverage in Australia at the moment.
Absolutely. And just a quick little plug for you, Josh. If you haven't gone and read Josh's great piece in Shoot Farkin.
Stop.
Heard that? I said that correctly. Farkin. Yes. Head over to their blog. It's on Josh's Twitter page as well. Go and give it a read. It's a great little sort of summation of how we're all feeling about watching Stan Sport, a bit of your sort of personal journey and sort of how you've consumed football growing up, Josh. Really good read. So take a bit of time out tonight and give it a bit of a suss. But yeah, I must say, Josh, the Stan Sport coverage for the price, we all have our thoughts about the pricing. It has been sensational. I can't wait. Like, I'm a bit upset that Milan's not the feature game tomorrow, so I won't be able to take in the big three's thoughts in the early morning, and I'll have to kind of sift between and do some quick switch arounds on the Chromecast in the halftime break. So yeah, I'm excited. I reckon it's added that extra bit of excitement about Champions League again, because something probably we haven't felt in how long? 8 years, 7 years since the Champions League left SBS and went to Bein. So it's great.
All right, before we go, I'm just going to get some predictions from you for the big games. Firstly, Milan, Atletico Madrid at San Siro.
Look, I'm very confident, Josh. Atleti lost against Alaves on the weekend. They've kind of stuttered a little bit. I don't know if you saw the photo of Diego Simeone, but it literally looks like his hair's falling out at the moment. He looks disheveled. First game back at the San Siro for Milan in the Champions League. Last time they played at the San Siro in the Champions League was against Atleti in the round of 16 7 years ago. So a bit of poetry there. But I think Milan's going to get the job done tomorrow. I have a really good feeling about this game. I think it's going to be a bit of a scrappy 1-0.
Water is wet. You know, death, taxes, Nick predicting Milan wins. I think I'm going to go for a draw in that one. And PSG versus Man City at the Parc des Princes. The sports washing derby. What are you going for here?
Look, PSG lost that, drew that first game. Probably may as well have been a loss against Club Brugge. I'm going to go with 2-2. I reckon it's going to be a real fun sort of 2-2 open game, sort of end-to-end kind of football. As long as Guardiola doesn't overthink a Champions League group stage game, it should be a good watch.
I'm going to go for City here. I don't think Messi's going to play. I don't think PSG have quite worked out the kinks in accommodating their star players this season. I don't know. Not feeling it so far with PSG. It's a bit of a Galacticos syndrome. People forget the Galacticos regime was not nearly as successful as it should have been. So when you're carrying three guys who don't do a lot of defending, suddenly in modern football, that makes it difficult. And I'm not sure if Messi's going to play or not. It's very murky on that front. So it makes it difficult to predict, to be honest. But Nick, we're over time, so I think we'll leave it there. Thank you for your company. Thank you to Bill Papastoiadis for joining us. We'll have his interview and the full show up on our podcast platforms shortly after the show. But Nick, until next time. And thank you to so many people for tuning in. We love the comments. It's so good. Actually, one more. Before we go, JB Blockboy says, what would be better, Stan getting the EPL rights or Paramount getting them? I know what the A-League would prefer.
Yeah, of course. So definitely, if you're speaking as an A-League consumer, as someone who as well probably is thinking about what would be good for the A-League, you definitely say Paramount. But for me, based off coverage so far, off the very small sample size from both, I'd love to see more Max Rushton, Craig Foster, and Mark Bosnich. So give it to me. Give it to me. But add Nick Stoll. Get Nick Stoll on camera. We want Nick Stoll on camera.
anyone who's watched FN9 in the past few years knows how good value Nick Stoll is on the mic or on camera. And even with the World Game live streams that he was doing with Lucy Zelich, RIP, TWG. But I think we'll leave it there. Thanks to everyone for tuning in. It's been fantastic engagement today. We love it. And we'll talk to you again on Thursday.